adopt it and make it your own baby or take it to the closest police station or call a social worker. It is your responsibility. It's not your fault, though. You know, no one's going to blame you for that baby being on your porch or that baby not having parents. But it's now something that you have to take charge, you know? You have to take steps in order to fulfill that responsibility at this point. And I feel that as a society, we failed at claiming our responsibilities and showing up in our lives for moments that really called for it. And that's why applying Islamic values, which are actually based on our innate quality as humans, has become so hard because we've mutated, you know? We've mutated away from how we're meant to be, and we're so broken, and we're so shattered, and we're so lost. It's so hard to make sense out of Revelation now, and it's sad.
I think it's not so hard to make sense of Revelation, because when you still living in this world, it's so hard to make sense of this world.
My Lord, show me right from wrong. Give me light, make me strong. I know the road is long. Make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long. Make me strong.
It has happened a lot for me in my personal life, my private life. There are cases where I really cannot understand and cannot make the right choice. If I take the right-hand choice, it's loss. If I take the left-hand choice, it's loss. I really don't know what to do. I'm like trapped. But then when I go to the Quran, like just to like do a research or to study it, to contemplate on some verses, I find so much serenity, so much depth.
MashaAllah.
Seriously, the words, they're full of light.
That's why Imam Sajjad said that if people in the East and people in the West perish, I wouldn't feel lonesome as long as I have the Quran.
Seriously.
I'd have somewhere to turn to.
It makes total sense. And the reason we have lost sense in life is because we have lost our track in life.
Exactly.
We've been talking about haya and modesty, of course, from a Quranic and Hadithi perspective. Zainab, I wanted to bring into our audience's attention one specific categorization that we have for haya. And because so far we've been talking about haya in like your outer appearance, in the way you talk, in the way you eat, in the way you interact with other people. But I'm going to look at haya from another perspective.
Sure.
I think we can see haya in terms of whom is seeing us, right?
Right.
Because oftentimes we are ashamed or embarrassed to do something in front of, like, what when I say I'm ashamed or embarrassed, the first thing that comes to your mind is anyone
watching.
Looking?
Yeah.
Is there a camera?
Exactly.
See, so we are so sensitive and self-conscious with regards to other people judging us. And we want to preserve, you know, we've built a shield around ourselves. We put a beautiful mask on our faces, which is not necessarily the same as who we are inside. And we are so worried of if this mask is going to be a little bit tipped away from our face and people would actually see who is this weak person underneath this beautiful, you know.
Facade, yeah.
So the thing is that this is the first kind of haya, which is in the first level, that we are afraid, we are ashamed or embarrassed of other people watching us or knowing our faults. But if you're a little more concerned, if you're a deeper person, you would care about if, you know, the angels are looking at you. You're being watched. And in the Islamic perspective, based on the verses of the Noble Quran that we're going to mention them later on, I'm just going to say the category. So the second one is the angels. The third one is?
The imam.
Imam? Well, they fall into the category of, you know, angels.
Oh, okay. And what is it then?
God. For many people, they don't care that God is watching them. they say, you know, he's my friend, or like, it's okay, you know, right. I don't care.
Okay.
So people, they hide things from people. Second, at a higher level, the angels.
The angels.
Three, God. And the fourth one, which is the deepest level of Haya, is, we've talked about it before, yourself.
Mm.
You come to the realization. You know, it's exactly the same approach as that beautiful narration that says people would are after heaven because of different reasons. One who just likes to enjoy the blessings, one who doesn't like to be chastised, one who looks at it like the view of a merchant, the view of, do you remember that hadith? I think it was from Imam
the view of a slave, the view of a merchant, and the finally it was the view of a free man.
Yeah, which you really, really want that satisfaction, this radiyat and mardiyat, this that you want to be well pleased with God and God well pleased with you, right? So at the fourth stage, you have truly understood and realized your true gem.
Mm.
And
I'm worth more than this.
Exactly. And you don't want to shatter that kind of understanding or perception or reality that is within you, right? So looking at it one by one, I just want to share with you a beautiful hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam that says, أَحْسَنُ الْحَيَاءِ إِسْتِهْيَاءُكَ مِنْ نَفْسِكَ, which means that the best kind of modesty is the modesty that you have with regards to yourself. Or another beautiful narration from Imam Ali alayhi salam that says, حَيَاءَ الرَّجُلْ مِنْ نَفْسِهِ ثَمَرَةَ الْإِيمَانِ, the fruit of believing in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the modesty of a person with regards to oneself.
Right.
So this iman, this belief system, the deeper it is, the more you know your worth, the more you know who you are, where you have come from, and where you're heading to, the better, the more clear your value system, and the better your modesty. Because all of these are somehow related.
There's obviously so much more that we need to talk about regarding the concept of haya, but that's all the time we have for today's episode of Muslim Lady. Thank you so very much for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the Lawwam?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
In the limelight.
As Brexiteers turn on each other, Brexit politics moves fast. Until now, the Tories plan to move on only reviving Brexit-done triumphalism to re-arouse the captured red wall at the election. Labour just wanted to bury the whole issue. We now present you an article written by Polly Toynbee under the heading, Brexiteers Are Waking Up to the Damage They've Done. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Polly Toynbee's article. Brexit has breached the fishing boats at Hastings, a seaside town and borough in East Sussex on the south coast of England. The two-man crew of Paul Joy's boat, Kaya, have left for shore jobs after the price of the Hastade land fell to just 2 pence a kilo. Exports to the European Union are Brexit blighted, with fishers across Britain poleaxed by the new costs and regulations, their catches rotting before they reach the European Union markets. It's costing them millions of pounds already. For the last 2 years, Joy, a passionate Brexiteer, has consistently told me he believes his industry would be shafted in any trade deal. Outraged at the UK government's failure to secure British fishing rights for 12 miles around the coast, he says betrayed, sacrificed, and now crippled by the export costs. So when Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab has the effrontery to tell the BBC's Andrew Marr that this is a great deal for the fishing industry, he must know it's not true. Other industries want to know if Boris Johnson's promised compensation for fishing losses means a huge subsidy in perpetuity for this less than 0.2% sliver of the economy. Because of the problems exploding in one industry after another, in less than 3 Brexit weeks, are not going away. Friction is the new normal, as recently the chief European Union negotiator Michel Barnier said firmly, things have changed for good. UK choices mean mechanical, obvious, inevitable consequences when you leave the single market, and that's what the British wish to do. It's not French revenge or bloody-minded Brussels, but ordinary life as a third country. The plight of the fishers is just a vivid emblem for the new blow that is falling on exporting parts of the economy. British politician and former journalist Michael Gove's December warnings of bumpy moments upped an octave in the first week of this year to Britain should prepare for significant border disruption. That well-staged last-minute deal melodrama was designed to end Brexit stories, relegating all boring details of the aftermath to the business pages. But not so. The stories are so strong even the ardent Brexit-creating press can't resist them, though now those newspapers add a self-exculpatory slant that blames the government for a bad Brexit. Here are some random discoveries since Brexit Day. The Sun warns of Brexit's threat to the Cheltenham Festival. Last year, 180 Irish horses ran, but this year, Brexit leaves Irish racehorse trainers fearing colossal tax bill. Likewise, the cost of taking UK show jump horses across the Channel is prohibitive for their British owners. Motorsport faces similar fees for cars shipped to European Union races. The fashion industry, especially ASOS type, cheap end with small margins, is hitting a rules of origin crisis, paying new duties on its many products manufactured outside the European Union. Fun stories in The Sun include the lorry driver crossing the Gibraltar-Spain border, whose bottle of Nando's sauce is confiscated, along with all those ham sandwiches snatched by the Dutch. The Daily Telegraph reports the fight of Europeans from England, but not from Remain-voting Scotland and Northern Ireland. Farmers Weekly sends up flares about plunging meat prices due to delayed exports. All of these losses to a host of smaller industries mount up fast, but look at the Sunday Times report on the crisis in a car industry that's worth £42 billion in exports, employing 823,000 people, where car part delays are halting production at some factories. Yet still, most economically dead is the unseen slipping away of invisibles, where about 80% of the economy in services is already leaking tax revenues. Bloomberg keeps up its grim recording of no likely progress. It reports City of London's plight laid bare as Brexit deal hopes fade. And then there is the unfolding Northern Ireland disaster. Stena Line Ferries has diverted its Great Britain Northern Ireland sea crossings to the Rosslare to Cherbourg route instead. The Times headline reads, "Doldrums ahead in shipping forecasts as Brexit complicates customs." Over the past year, I have been following the impending haulage disaster through Manfreight, a 200-lorry company in Coleraine. Its owner, Chris Slowey, says no, the crisis in Great Britain, United Kingdom crossing, is not down to teething problems, as Dominic Raab put it. But it's baked into the nature of Brexit. His lorries carrying exports to England return empty, doubling his costs as English exporters find it too costly to sell to Northern Ireland, and that's permanent. The Telegraph reports that 1 in 10 lorries are being turned back at the European Union border. Delays will continue. Spot checks at EU borders are standard practice. So will queues, lorry parks and roadside squalor. The pandemic has worsened the Brexit effect, but that was a good reason to extend the transition period. It's only human to confess to some Remainer I told you so glee when ex-MP Kate Hoey wails in the Telegraph. The Tories have betrayed Northern Ireland with their Brexit deal. What on earth did she expect? That's why Northern Ireland wisely voted to remain. Expect a lot more shocked Brexiters to discover what they have done. The Brexit cabinet itself is on a steep learning curve. Here's one Telegraph columnist who writes, "We Brexiters are being blamed for the problems we warned about. In reality, the fault lies squarely with the government and with poor planning." Oh, the Schadenfreude. That's a sharp U-turn from the Telegraph's too eager January 1st report from the Dover front. Chaos? What chaos? As Brexiteers turn on each other, Brexit politics moves fast. Until now, the Tories plan to move on, only reviving Brexit-done triumphalism to re-arouse the captured red wall at the election. Labour just wanted to bury the whole issue. But the scale of the eruptions bursting out in one sector after another requires opposition to find its footing on this tricky terrain. Many, like Paul Joyer on Hastings Beach, are still as passionately pro-Brexit as ever. Fearlessly, Labour needs to regain its voice of outrage that Brexit leaders deliberately shut their ears to what leaving the single market and the customs union really meant. A better Brexit deal really was possible.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in qarn mojza kardid, millat Iran millat mojza asay qarn ast.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini rahbar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, and the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. We are carrying on with these programs to shed light on the greatness of this great personality, Imam Khomeini. So, once again, I've got an expert in the studio, Sayyid Taqi Razavi, who's given us our valuable time, an Islamic scholar and researcher in the holy city of Qom, who has been guiding us through the life and times of Imam Khomeini. We spoke in the last program about the background, the holy lineage of the Imam, which is, you know, of great significance because he does come from the Holy Prophet's family, peace be upon them all. And of course, I'd like to say here at this moment that Imam Khomeini, really, as we will go through these programs and discover, he really gave us a glimpse of what our infallible Imams were like, because there's been a huge gap since the time of the great occultation of the 12th Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, may God hasten his appearance soon. But we got a little glimpse in the last 30 years or so, something of what the Holy Prophet's family are like. And in terms of their character, their personality, their distinguishing virtues, their scholarship, of course, and their knowledge, you know, is always a cut above the rest. And, you know, he gave us a glimpse of that. But inshallah, God willing, as we go through these programs, we are going to shed light on this in greater depth. So, Sayyid Taqi, salam, and thank you very much again for being on the program and giving us your valuable time.
Alaykum salam. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. That's great. So, Sayyid Taqi, we got to the stage, as we say, we were also putting in the background so that our listeners could understand that in what context all this was happening. And we got to the point where, you know, there are some interesting events happening around the town of Khomeini. And we were talking about the fact that because of the Qajar dynasty was at its lowest point, you know, really they had no law and order. Things were pretty much at the end of that particular era. And the British, with their machinations and their imperialist agenda, were changing things here in Iran for the worst, and I'll emphasize that. So what was happening in Khomeini at that particular moment in time where, you know, as you mentioned, we were getting to the history of Imam Khomeini's father in the town of Khomeini?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, really, I mean, during that time, between 1985, his birth, and, and 1903, of his shahadat, and you say, what? His shahadat? Yes.
Yes, yes, it's martyrdom.
Imam Khomeini's father was martyred.
Martyred, yes,
and that area was raising a revolutionary alim-e-deen, revolutionary scholar.
Absolutely.
This Sayyid Mustafa, as his name was, Sayyid Mustafa al-Khomeini, he was Imam Khomeini's father.
Yes.
As I said, born in 1885.
Yes.
He was sent to study Islamic studies in Isfahan.
In Isfahan.
Isfahan. He did his most of his studies in Isfahan. And then after completing certain levels in Isfahan, he made his way to Najaf and Samarra, and then come back to Khomeini.
Right. So because, of course, at that time, Najaf was, you know, the central...
Indeed, that was the hub of...
The institution, the central Hawza, you know, of...
Indeed, that was the hub
clergy.
Of Islamic education and learning.
Sure.
And on acquiring a a substantially high quality of studies,
sure,
he returned back to Khomeini.
In a later program we'll discuss the fact that, you know, how the Hawza system got established here in the holy city of Qom.
Indeed.
By mm-hmm. Ayatollah Yazdi, of course.
And there were other Hawzas in Iran already. There were certain Hawzas in Mashhad.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Hawza in Iraq. There was
sure.
a Hawza in Isfahan.
Sure.
Qom already had its own breeding point of ulama training.
Sure.
Not as a centralized institution.
Right.
But certainly if we look at a hadith from Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salam,
mm-hmm.
which talks about the fact that there will be a time near the Zuhur of the 12th Imam.
That's correct. Yes, that's a very famous
From Najaf would go down into the ground like
A snake, and it would re-emerge in Qom.
Exactly, and it would raise his head up in Qom.
Qom.
You're going back to Imam Jafar Sadiq al-Islam's tradition, Imam mm-hmm. Muhammad Baqir al-Islam's
but
tradition.
But of course, the Hawza in Qom took on a totally different color, but that's
indeed,
something
but
else.
Indeed, that, that is because of the nature. That is because of the nature of the revolutionized nature of the ulema that we're building around the various experiences of fatawa given
sure.
by
and we are not digressing by any means, because of course, you know, like the father of Imam Khomeini and Imam Khomeini himself, you know, they took central roles in the establishment of this Hawza system. So that it's even if we are mentioning it now, and of course we'll discuss it in depth in a different program, but it's important to mention that these are all elements into the building up of what we're discussing here.
Indeed, not only just elements, the fact that the nature of the Hawza's operative and how it will later on take on, like Imam Khomeini and others, to guide it, to define its define and maintain its independent from oppressive regimes.
Yes, yes. No, this is very important.
Yeah,
the independence
you have
aspect.
You
of
have
it.
Najaf, which was always independent. From any environment to be able to dictate to it. And you see, that's why you've got Sayyid Mustafa Khomeini in Khomeini, his father, taking on a very strong position, a very hard position against the oppressive Khans who were around there. You know,
that's
because
true.
Of the fact that he was able to maintain that independence of the Ali Medin.
Because,
scholar.
Of course, it has to be mentioned that these oppressive Khans were, at the behest of the corrupt ruling government, were taking lands.
No, they were taking land, but not only that, they were oppressing the people of that
land. Of course, I mean, they were...
And, you know, because of the fact that Imam Khomeini's father was a independent thinking person...
Sure, and resisting against this practice.
Resisting against this practice.
Criminal practice,
and,
yes.
And encouraging people to be resistant, demonstrate their resistance to them.
Yeah.
Yes, it meant in sacrificing life. A lot of people sacrificed their lives in Khomeini in being firmly against these people. They were tortured, they were lamed, the bodies, they were injured in various types of injuries that they had to face. And of course, the very fact that the Khans or the oppressive authorities in those areas were looking at the public as if they were their personal servants.
That's right.
That Imam Khomeini's father stood up against that.
Of course.
And the fact that, you know, there were so many others who were fighting amongst themselves as Khans to take up positions in front of the Shah of that time, that they would be even more evil than the last one.
That's right. The brutality was,
you know, the brutality
was
didn't
awful.
Cease.
Awful.
So
yeah.
In this process of the brutality that existed, Imam Khomeini's father continuously stood up against these people.
Mm.
And it so happens, I mean, it's really interesting thing one needs to analyze Imam Khomeini's life in relation to this, because Imam Khomeini, being a younger member of the children of Sayyid Mustafa, he was experiencing things a lot more later on after his father's shahadat.
Yes, yes.
You see, because
after his
father's martyrdom. Because his father was martyred in 1903, and we're using the word martyr. Why? Because you see, Sayyid Mustafa, he was seeing that the Khan of that time was very oppressive, taking up land, doing a lot of atrocities, in killing as well.
There was a violation
people.
Of women's honor there
honor
as
and
well.
Everything. So what he, with a group of people of Khomeini, decided that they would go and visit the province's head, who himself was a corrupt so-and-so anyway. But the very fact that that type of audience was available just for the sake of
sure.
demonstrating some type of interaction
sure.
with the community,
mm.
that these people on their way to represent Khomeini to the province's governor, that on the way there, the gangster of the time of Khomeini decided that he was going to eliminate them from reaching from before they were able to reach the governor and present them their case.
That's right. This is what is mentioned in the text, isn't it? That it was during his journey from Khomeini to Iraq or on the way back that
on the way there.
Yeah, on the way there that this had happened. This awful
Indeed.
Crime had been
and
committed.
And they shot him and he was
oh
killed.
My goodness.
And of course, the people of Khomeini did eventually got their reward for
the qasas, wasn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly. Yeah. For what had happened.
Mm.
But what I'm trying to say is that Imam Khomeini was experiencing was in his bodily existence had felt all these things that had happened around him.
Yeah.
But what was really important, I think, which needs to be brought into this context, is that we have hundreds and hundreds of ulema, thousands of ulema, probably from 1920 up to now, who have
That's
gone through
right.
the Hawza.
I mean, men of great prominence.
You know,
great.
But what made Imam Khomeini Imam Khomeini?
Exactly. That is the question.
That is a very important
question.
And one of those things which I personally feel is the way Sayyid Mustafa Khomeini felt it necessary to have Imam Khomeini raised in a particular way.
And that's what we want to talk about, because this background is very, very interesting, and it does give us very important lessons in the raising of our own children.
You see,
as
what
well.
I found was something really interesting, and this
please.
was when Imam Khomeini was born. His mother could not feed him milk.
Right.
She was, and these are interesting correlating concepts.
Right,
look
right.
at Rasulullah Akram when he was born, his mother could not.
That's right. He was given
to a wet nurse.
A wet nurse.
But then that's interesting because he was given to a wet nurse. I mean, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala creates his own rationale for people to understand.
Yeah.
But it is a fact that the Jews of Medina knew of the fact that the Prophet was going to be born. So
that's
they
correct.
were always waiting for that time to get their guidance. But what was also a difficult thing was that they weren't going to allow the Prophet to survive. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created an abnormality, but the child would be taken out of the Quraysh's environment that they would not know where Muhammad was, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.
Interesting. Very
thus depriving them the audience of him and the fact that they
so
could eliminate.
So even in Imam Khomeini's life, even at a very, very early stage, we're seeing parallels
Indeed,
with the history of Islam.
The interesting parallel here is the fact that his mother could not. What changed the environment there is that not, God forbid, that his mother was not a spiritual lady, because she was.
No, she was a very pious
what happened,
lady, of course.
What happened was that when the child was given to the wet nurse, Imam Khomeini's father said that, look, you'll feed the child, but I will give you the food. I will supply you my own food. So that, you know, on one side he's talking about everything being absolutely halal. From my
right
own income.
Right from the beginning.
From my own income. But then what he asked the wet nurse was really interesting. He says, every time you feed the child, I'll give you the food every month, but throughout the month, read a few surahs to the child whilst you're feeding the child.
The surahs from the Quran.
The Quran. When the month finishes and he takes her food, he said, did you fulfill that requirement?
Right.
So the lady says, sir, you said that I should do a few surahs whilst I'm feeding the child. During this month, I've read several Qurans in front of this child.
MashaAllah. My goodness. That is amazing.
You know, so this kind of spiritual, from spiritual out, you know, from the outset, he's being spiritually pasted. You know, the milk that the mother's, the wet nurse is giving him is going to him while she's reciting Quran, he's listening to Quran whilst, you know, we think sometimes, what's a 2 month, 1 month child going to experience
but
from
the
this?
The other thing is that, you know, it begs the question, did the father have some insight as to, you know, the birth of this particular child? Already he was beginning to see something
no,
about
No, you see,
this?
What is important, brother, is that if you yourself are a spiritually minded person, you naturally do things which are the consequences of your spirituality.
That is true. That
you're
is
not kind
very
of planning
true.
Anything special.
No, but you're right. It's the complete culture, the complete
and that is
ethos
the culture,
in which
exactly.
he's...
And that was the culture that Sayyid Mustafa was embedded with. And he was passing it on
to his son.
His next offspring. In the same manner, his own son, who was known later on as Ayatollah Pasindide.
Yes,
he wasn't
yes.
anything small.
Yeah, we'll speak about him,
but
of
what
course.
I'm trying
yes.
to bring in this arena is that the spirituality of his father was also passed to him as well.
Yes,
he wasn't
yes.
anything, you know, the leftover of what was trained for Imam Khomeini that Ayatollah Pasindide came out of. No,
yes.
he was an entity of his own.
Own.
And he stood firm in his own identity.
Quite.
So, yeah, his shahadat in 1903, obviously Imam Khomeini was only 5 months old.
Five months old at that time.
So, you know, it wouldn't have kind of I saw what happened to my father type of thing. Mm. But what was always reminded as an event, and that lineage of fighting the oppressed was already embedded in the bloodline.
Which comes from the Holy Ahlul Bayt all the time, because this is their martyrdom, their resistance at the of oppressors in their particular period, as we talk about the infallible imams, you know, is a tradition which was going to be followed by this holy family as well.
And in 1918, his mother and his beloved auntie passed away because of cholera. And at that time, Imam Khomeini is only 16.
He's 16 at the time, yes.
And you see again,
The parallel that you can draw with Prophet Muhammad.
Exactly.
Prophet that, Muhammad, peace be upon the loss of Hazrat Khadija and Hazrat Abu Talib.
The very fact that, you know, he's losing relatives who would be of a supportive...
Who were central in his upbringing. Yeah.
Exactly. So Imam Khomeini at 18. But then you see that's the demise of his mom and auntie.
Yeah.
But the thing is, as of... I think it's from the dates that I have... scribbled down, is that from about 1906, when he was about 5 years old,
right.
He's already studying Hosa type of courses. He started memorizing the Quran, he's reading the Quran, he's learning various...
Quranic sciences exactly. at a very early age.
Sorry, 1908, when he was about 6 years old. As of that time, when he was 6 years old, he's studying the Quran, he's memorizing the Quran, the recitation of the Quran, various Islamic holy books he becomes familiar with as time goes on. You know, he and the Persian language.
Of course,
he starts mastering the Persian language and the whole old text of Persian languages.
Yes, yes.
He starts mastering them as time goes on.
Right.
That
right.
You know, his studies, want for study, has already started. He's not playing around, so as to say, and left to listen to the next LP that comes out.
In other words, he's already following the Sunnah and the tradition of prophets from before, who, you know, you remind me of Prophet Yahya, actually, who was asked at one time to be playing with kids, and he said, "I am not here to play around in life. Life is not." Was not created in vain. So, in other words, you know, you're already talking about a very powerful tradition, in which, you know, the scholarship is already manifesting itself at a very early age.
But then you see, alhamdulillah, when it comes to Islamic learning, you find that he's also learning the tools of life as well, learning how to ride the horse. He becomes an expert in horse riding.
Right. Mm-hmm.
He becomes expert in using defensive equipment.
He had a great love for sports at a very early age as well.
And you know, he knew how to defend himself with the weapons of the time.
Yeah.
You know, and
there's an anecdote or a story associated with that, because of, as you pointed out, with the situation with his father, you know, and what Khomeini as a town was going through because of the Khans. Imam Khomeini was very active in his teenage, learning the gun, and of course they were already making what they call the bunkers, by which they were resisting these raids that were coming from these bandits.
All the time, certain relatives were reluctant to see him. Maybe he would get killed or something
that's
like that.
That's true.
He would still endeavor to learn the tools of the trade of defense at that time.
Yeah.
And it was,
and it shows him to be a very brave character right from the start.
Indeed, and when it came to target practice and things like that, he was one for the eye on targeting the having a target at the necessary item. Mm-hmm. So you could see he's learning a vast range of expertise, which later on proved to be extremely essential in his own character building.
Right.
You know, and the fact that whilst he is developing in his studies. You have, if we were to really break Imam Khomeini's life into certain phases,
we
can see that, you know, this is a second major phase of his building.
Yeah.
From the age of, you could say, 6 years old to 1962, a whole wide range of period of learning that Imam Khomeini is going through, from not only just learning but also teaching.
Yeah,
that's to say, you know, more and more he's experiencing for himself, not really dabbing into any kind of confrontational situation.
I think, of course, you know, we'll do this in a later program, but I think the depth of the mastery of his scholarship and the fact that, as I say, we'll mention in the depth that even the students of Imam Khomeini, I mean, honestly, I mean, at times I'm taken back, drawn back to Imam Jafar al-Sadiq, alayhi salam, when, you know, scholars of other traditions used to come and ask him questions, and he would say, well, please don't ask me that question. Please ask my student.
My student
this question. Yeah. Just to see the competency, the mastery of the teaching of what he was disseminating. But as I say, that's a later
but
thing.
But you see, what happened as we look at it in a chronological order?
Yeah, right.
You know, Imam Khomeini in about 1920. That's when the First World War is finished.
Well, it's finished, yes. And dramatic changes have taken place in the war.
Changes have taken place.
Yeah.
Yet
in the Muslim world,
he's alhamdulillah at a stage where he's expanding his knowledge more.
Right.
You know, his brother, Ayatollah Pasandide, who arranges
yes,
for him.
Yes, his tutelage was
exactly
more with his brother, wasn't it?
With
really?
His brother.
Yeah.
And you find that his brother had arranged him to go and study in Isfahan. But
right.
instead of going to Isfahan, he's directed towards Iraq. And that
Iraq,
in itself,
uh-huh.
Iraq. That
yeah.
in itself has been an essential learning process for him.
We'd like to mention for our listener, Iraq is not confused with Iraq, but
it's a central province
of a town very near Qom. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And there, the houses were being run, or there the main house in Iraq was being run by Ayatollah Abdul Karim Hari Yazdi.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one who was running that house and very well established house as it was.
Yes, I mean, he was the founding father of the establishment of the Hawza as we know it today in Qom. But of course it came at a price because the Pahlavis had now come into power, especially with Raza Pahlavi. And of course he was an army man, very brutal, very irreligious. He immediately put in the ban of the veil, which was following from Ataturk's thing, what he was doing with the decline of the Ottoman Empire. So a lot of things were happening which were very anti-Islam, very anti-Sharia. And of course, you know, there's that horrible story, but it has to be mentioned, that when this Raza Khan came to Qom, the leading authority at that time, one of the Ayatollahs here, was beaten by the Shah. In public, in a manner to try to humiliate him. But of course, the knock-on effect was different because, of course, in the public's mind, this brought out the true nature of the beast that the public was facing, especially here in Qom.
And you see, particularly with the fact that Ayatollah Hari Yazdi was a highly respected personality.
Sure, sure.
His Hawza or the management of the Hawza in Iraq had a reputation of its own in training of ulema,
sure.
That it could not be contested in any way whatsoever.
Right.
And you know, particularly with Imam Khomeini going over there and experiencing at a very young age, a very tender age of 18 years old,
yes,
that he's
yes.
really kind of building his whole process of learning from this environment.
Mm.
That, you know, when Ayatollah Yazdi moved the madrasa, moved the environment of the Hawza from Iraq to Qom, which was in 1920 itself,
mm-hmm.
that we see that Imam Khomeini doesn't hesitate in moving over with him.
He
finds that this is an opportunity not to be missed.
Mm.
And really and truly, where a lot of people may think, well, you know, some of our community people think, okay, I've studied 6 years, 7 years, let me go back to my community. No, Imam Khomeini wants to venture further in his
I think this shows something
study.
About even at Imam Khomeini, even at as a teenager, he shows great insight, great depth and wisdom in his decision-making of where he wants to go and study and what subjects he wants to study. Because, of course, he's taking on the Hawza studies, the traditional Quranic sciences studies, but he's also learning mathematics. He's also learning other subjects mm-hmm. as well, which shows a wisdom and an intellect superior, perhaps even beyond his contemporaries, that exactly what kind of target, what kind of goals he wants to reach.
You see, but the goals he he keeps those goals under control.
That's true, because he's always against the ego, isn't he?
He's against the ego. But he was of a very important opinion that whoever is the leader of the Shia Ummah at a particular time should be the person responsible to dictate what the political environment should be.
Absolutely.
He did not venture out beyond his limits identified himself with in relation to the leader.
But that shows a great wisdom in there.
Not only just wisdom, but what it shows is the total nature of Shia opinion. If you look at Karbala,
and the divergence is allowed there.
Not only just divergence, the fact that recognition of the Imam of the time. You know, you had Imam Zainul Abidin al-Islam.
That's right, because
ill and everything. Yet still, Hazrat Zainab says, "You're the Imam of the time. What should we do?"
And the other thing is that we have to point out that even Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who was a completely revolutionary character alongside his brother Imam Hassan alayhi salam, but if Imam Hassan alayhi salam stayed quiet during the rule of Bani Umayyah during Muawiyah's 20-year period, Imam Hussein was quiet as well.
And this is what we're learning from what Imam Khomeini had learned, that when you identify with the leader of the time or whoever it is, that Ayatollah Hariri may be Ayatollah Hariri, may it be Ayatollah Bourjedi at a later time, you do not venture beyond that. You can guide and you can support, but you do not venture behind the authority.
And I think that the support of Imam Khomeini at that particular stage is also very, very important. As you say, it does speak volumes in itself.
Indeed.
But we are going to carry on with that in the next edition of the program, where we will go further into the scholarship of Imam Khomeini, and then later on the works that he starts to come up as an accomplished scholar. And of course, he also achieved his becoming a mujtahid at a very early stage in his life as well. But we'll get on to that at a later program. At this moment in time, my dear audience, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed the program as much as I have as well. So thank you for listening today. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and blessings of Allah and His mercy be upon you all.
In the past few years, the United Arab Emirates has been seeking to increase its influence on Lebanese politics and society. Decades ago, the Emiratis launched their Lebanon project by running charities. Today, they're pulling the strings at the highest socio-political levels in the country. In late June, Arabic Post wrote that the UAE security apparatus has been playing a leading role in stirring up recent violence and riots in Lebanon. Quoting from the Lebanese Interior Minister Mohamed Fahmy through an unnamed source, the news outlet continued, "Friendly countries are generous to us, but to be honest, they're suffocating us." Fahmy didn't explicitly mention the country he accused of fomenting sedition, but private sources confirmed to Arabic Post that the accusations were all leveled against Abu Dhabi.
Lebanon is historically a very important location of the world. It's the midpoint region between the East and the West. It has a lot of resources. And plus, it is a very key player on the political, geographical level. So any country actually will want to consider having a part in Lebanon, especially if that country is also playing on a large scale with other countries. So I guess that they will consider that Lebanon is a court where they can score different goals over each other.
Meanwhile, sources close to the Hezbollah resistance movement say that they have evidence that proves the Emirati's involvement in the Beirut events and reveals their support of anti-Hezbollah groups.
Abu Dhabi doesn't actually care a lot for politics, the more it cares for economy, and the more it cares for technological advancement, and the more it cares for its own good. And she knows that all of those things are related for saying no to this key component in Lebanon. So that's why they're very clear with themselves. They know what they're doing. So apparently saying yes to Hezbollah means they're going to lose a lot on the international level. So why should they do that?
Competing with Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf countries, the UAE has been seeking to expand its presence in Lebanon, first under the cover of charitable activities after the end of the civil war in 1990. Then they supported the former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri, funded various Islamic societies, mosques, Muslim clerics, and founded medical clinics and schools.
Well, as an activist in human development, and I really love to work in workshops and human development and skills, they're doing a great job, Emirates, they're doing a great job concerning all of those activities. I would just advise them if they would just, you know, not use them for covering other political acts, because they are able to be in Lebanon and do a lot of acts, and we're able to exchange a lot of things with them on the cultural level if they don't have hidden agendas.
Moreover, following the widespread protests in the Arab world in 2011, Abu Dhabi made its decision to stop its financial support of Islamic societies for their close association with the Muslim Brotherhood and other political Islamic currents. According to Watan Serb, the UAE ambassador frequently visited the Grand Mufti of Lebanon and asked him to remove from their positions the clerics and judges affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood and those sympathetic to Arab revolutions, and not to allow them to run for positions in the Supreme Islamic Council or other administrative positions. Moreover, sources from Islamic Group say that a group of Emirati officers have been pressuring the Lebanese authorities to dissolve the group and close their institutions.
Well, actually, because the Muslim Brotherhood and the other parties, they have this ideological way of dealing with things. And I told you, Dubai and Abu Dhabi, and you know, it's like, it's sometimes they call themselves like the jewel of the West in the East. So they adopted the Western methodologies, they adopted the Western way with all its bad and good aspects. I'm not saying everything is bad, but they adopted everything and they went into this way of living and this lifestyle. So, and this is completely against what some Islamic groups such as the Muslim Brotherhood calls for or deal with. There's a huge ideological difference. There's a huge ideological gap between Muslim Brotherhood and such groups and what the leaders at Dubai actually call for, what they aspire for, what they want. So it's very normal to see them not on the same page, and they don't agree on the same terms.
Meanwhile, the current UAE ambassador, Hamad Al-Shamsi, has opened extensive communication channels with Lebanese Christian personalities in several regions and provided unlimited support to Beirut Governor Ziad Shabib to help him with his projects, such as the renovation of churches and other Christian facilities in Beirut. The Emiratis have also worked hard to hire Lebanese media outlets to their own benefit by having them promote the role of the UAE in the country. News outlets such as Nida al-Watan are now clearly at the UAE's service in its competition with even the Saudi Kingdom and its adversity with Turkey, which is experiencing a growing popularity in the Western Asian country. By some credible sources, it was Abu Dhabi that foiled in 2017 the Saudi coup attempt against former Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri when the Saudis detained him in Riyadh and forced him to resign. Watan News website has recently revealed the UAE Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed refused his country's participation in the coup plan against Hariri and informed Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman of this. A few days after Hariri's mysterious resignation, bin Zayed received Hariri in his palace. The move can be interpreted as a bid to undermine Saudi influence in Lebanon, which is now at a low ebb.
At that incident, Saudi Arabia was practicing a huge, vivid form of authority over the first political Sunni position in the Lebanese government, which is the prime minister. So Dubai would be crazy if she went with Saudi Arabia at that point. Dubai would never actually give such open space for Saudi Arabia to play in Lebanon. We said that there's this huge challenge between all the power figures of the world, power countries of the world. So it would be normal for Dubai to say no to that action. That doesn't mean that caring for Lebanon or the prime minister at that time. It means that this is simply against Dubai's the best interests in the region.
In 2018, Saad al-Hariri, who was the leader of the Future Movement, promised the Islamic group that they could be part of his alliance in the upcoming parliamentary elections. However, shortly after, Hariri backtracked on his promise and cut off his relations with them. Sources close to the Islamic group say Hariri made the decision under pressure from Abu Dhabi, that's at loggerheads with the group. After the resignation of Saad al-Hariri in January this year, now there are rumors that the Emiratis are helping his brother rise and return to the country's political arena just to make sure that they will maintain the equilibrium in Lebanon.
IRIB English Radio.